although they varied very widely, on the extent to which they might idealize or contest it. And yet, Krishnamohan also found it imperative to re-embrace parts of Sanskritic philosophical heritage in his theological writings. This was not a convert's unshed intellectual baggage. It was a very deliberate intellectual move, one which Banerjee came to formulate over the course of his long career. In his earlier works, such as the Dialogues, Krishnamohan attempted to argue rather traditionally that Sanskrit scriptures possessed no external proof of veracity, that the schools of Sanskrit philosophy were mutually contradictory and partially derived from heterodox Buddhist doctrine, and that there was little connection between abstract doctrines and social behavior in India. Thus, when the evangelical Scotsman James Ballantyne, principal of the Benares Sanskrit College, 1845 to 1861, attempted to prove to his Brahmin students that the Siddhantic astronomical texts logically led on to the truth of European science and thence to Christianity, a process that Chris Bailey as well as Michael Dodson have studied, Krishnamohan wondered whether the elements of truth in Sanskrit philosophy could really be uncovered from underneath the piles of rubbish that covered them. However, in one of his last publications, The Aryan Witness, published 1875, he asserted that the crucial elements of Christian revelation had been recorded and preserved in the Sanskrit scriptures, even though their true meaning had been forgotten. Thus, the self-sacrifice of the Purusha in the Rig Veda Samhita prophesied the redeeming sacrifice of Jesus Christ. In The Relation Between Christianity and Hinduism, published in 1881, he came to argue that the forefathers of the Hindus had an equally valuable foresight of the great mystery of godliness, as he called it, as the Jewish seers themselves, and hence they could and should embrace the Jesus of the New Testament as the perfect Prajapati of the Vedas. Krishnamohan's ideas look superficially like early fulfillment theology, a classic late 19th century missiological theory which proposed that all religions consisted of partial revelation that may be perfected by Christianity, but there is a twist here. In reaffirming the Sanskritic heritage, not only did Krishnamohan have an argument against Indian criticisms of cultural deviation, he also had a historicist argument against those that may claim Christianity as a Western gift to India. Several times, he attempted to establish the equivalence of Indians and Jews, and thereby the Indians and Jewish precursors to Christianity. Krishnamohan's ideas were borrowed and reiterated several times over the next 100 years in works of varying quality. Incidentally, such ideas were also used by those who continued to hold a more negative view of Sanskrit philosophy. Thus, the Chitpavan Brahmin convert Nehemiah Gore asserted that no other nations were as prepared for Christianity as Hindus, perhaps only barring the Jews themselves. This historicist strategy was repeatedly used to question the European conflation of Christian confession with specific dogmas, liturgies, church structure, and social standards. In the 20th century, Pandipeddi Chenchaya, an alumnus of the Madras Christian College and later a judge, rejected the historical relationship between the Old and New Testaments outright, saying, in quotes, "Why should it be necessary to understand the Old Testament to grasp the Sermon on the Mount? Why should a Hindu understand the complicated Pauline theology to follow Jesus? I can pick up material for an Old Testament in Hinduism, making selections in the light of what Jesus said and did. That was exactly what early Christians did and later Hindu converts ought to do." If the historical argument enabled a decoupling of Christian faith from its allegedly non-essential and historically specific correlates produced by the specific trajectory of European history, this paved the way for questioning some very fundamental aspects of the way in which Christianity was presented in India by European and American missionaries. Unsurprisingly, one such aspect was the disciplining role of Christian churches and Christian sacraments. Baptism was one such sacrament. Krishnamohan was initially unconvinced of its necessity, and when he did eventually seek baptism from Alexander Duff, he explicitly asked to be baptized at Duff's home rather than in the church, consciously choosing personal discipleship over denominational membership. The two earliest entirely indigenous Protestant churches in India, the Krishna Samaj of Bengal and the National Church of Madras, did not use baptism for initiation into an exclusive membership. In the 20th century, a Gujarati convert from Vaishnavism, Monilal Parekh, although baptized in the Anglican Church, rejected its value in a sermon he delivered in 1924, which was published in the National Christian Council Review, which said that where baptism should create the adhikara or right of bearing witness and being an acharya or prophet, which is how he translated it, it merely created membership in a community that was distant from society and anti-national. Parekh may have been extreme, but A.J. Appasamy, theologian, professor of Bishop's College, Calcutta, and later Bishop of Coimbatore in the Church of South India, reported with approval his father's exasperation with the uninspiring church and his exploration of yoga as a spiritual exercise. Apart from its foreignness, there was fragmentation into dozens of denominations replicating the missionary societies. The idea that a truly Indian church could arise out of these struck Pandipeddi Chenchaya as a capital joke. Deeply influenced by Aurobindo, Chenchaya recommended that in place of the church, there should be local religious communities or ashrams centered around a spiritual teacher or guru. In the early 20th century, a small number of European and American missionaries began to agree. The American Methodist missionary Ellie Stanley Jones suggested in his 1925 book, The Christ of the Indian Road, that the only way to preach Christ's universal message in a time of cultural and political conflict was to let go, in his words, of the very long line, a line that stretched from Genesis to Revelation onto Western civilization and to the Western Christian Church, and instead take one stand at Christ. However, even if such anti-ecclesiastical Christocentrism may have been applauded by the avant-garde new generation among the missionaries, it generally found little welcome from the established Christian hierarchy. Thus, in spite of the monastic tradition within the Catholic Church, Brahmabandha Upadhyay's efforts to create a Christian ashram came to nothing. And when Sadhu Sundar Singh, a Sikh convert to Christianity and a traveling ascetic preacher, made his appearance, he was wildly feted by the who's who of Indian Christianity, but was de-licensed by the Anglican Church for his inability to conform to denominational boundaries in his preaching. Liberal theology, which had created a temporary positive outlook among European and American missionaries towards such efforts, itself took a downturn in Europe in the 1930s with the rise of theological New Orthodoxy. In the eve of the World Missionary Conference at Tambaram, near Madras, a group of lay Tamil Christians found themselves preparing to rebut the argument that the gospel message was complete and unalterable, universally applicable in the same form, irrespective of differences in culture. They were specifically reacting to a book written by Hendrik Kramer, professor of history of religions at Leiden, called The Christian Message in the Non-Christian World, which repeated Karl Barth's Neo-Orthodoxy. The rethinking group, as they came to be known, urged that the Indian church should be able to think for itself. They came to be known as the Rethinking Group because they published a book called Rethinking Christianity in India. While they celebrated the reforming influence of Christianity on Hinduism and Hindus, they denounced the domination of Christianity by missionaries, who they accused of obstructing the development of a genuine Indian expression of Christianity. They denied that they were relativistic to truth and asserted that their aversion to contemporary church structures arose not from their social snobbery, but their dislike of foreign domination. How did this syncretic approach to faith and culture translate into the shaping of Christian political identity? Chandra Mallampally, pointing to the stark difference in the attitudes of Protestants and Catholics of Madras Presidency towards nationalism, has proposed a straightforward connection between the Sanskritized theology of the Protestants and their inclination towards a Sanskritized, that is, Hinduized nationalism. Actually, while Mallampally is correct about the Catholic-Protestant political divide in Madras, Protestants varied hugely in their political choices. there were sharp divides on key issues relating to community rights and nationalist politics, even among the rethinking group itself. Liberal theology in itself did not make a nationalist. However, the reverse was true. Those Indian Christians who were the most sympathetic towards nationalism and those who partly as a result emerged as national level leaders of the Christian community between the 1920s and 1940s did share the religious trajectory just described, and it formed a coherent intellectual basis for their non-sectarian approach to religious identity. The first of these leaders inevitably was Krishnamohan Banerjee, who had occasion not only to subscribe to worthy nationalist causes such as opposition to the Vernacular Press Act, but also to comment on the specific civil disabilities suffered by Indian Christians. Two common deprivations suffered from the point of view of upper class and caste men converted to Christianity was the loss of control over wives and children and over inheritable property, primarily because of social boycott. Krishnamohan himself supported the passing of a specific law in 1850, which we know as the Caste Disabilities Removal Act or the Lex Loci Act, which provided that, as a general principle, that the law of the land would not discriminate against anybody because of their change of religion and consequent change of caste. However, when it came to reclaiming undeniably community-specific rights, Krishnamohan, who himself had to rescue his wife from his family with the help of a British magistrate, took a different approach. Reacting to the Native Converts Marriage Dissolution Bill of 1866, which proposed to dissolve the marriage of a convert to Christianity if the unconverted spouse refused to resume conjugal relations within 3 months after so legally demanded in court, Krishnamohan Banerjee said rather harshly to the government select committee that the law was entirely the creation of missionaries who were totally unrepresentative of Indian Christians and who treated the latter as their serfs. Krishnamohan's point of view was that such a law would remove the possibility of slow reconciliation of deserting spouses and, by extension, the winning over of Hindu society in general. Banerjee was blatantly unfair. There were several missionaries who did support his point of view, such as Reverend Winter of the SPG mission to Delhi, who similarly stated that he didn't know of any Indian converts panting to be readmitted to marital life. On the other hand, Reverend W.T. Satyanathan of Madras, obviously an Indian clergyman, responded to Banerjee and Winter that the scale of religious conversions in South India made the legal measure essential, implying that the righteous moral posture of North Indian and Bengali Christians arose from their being acquainted with an unrepresentatively small number of conversions. A similar debate over who best understood the interests of Indian Christians animated the All India Conference of Indian Christians, which was formed in 1914 and which was the first nationwide political forum of Indian Christians. In reality, and in spite of periodic recruitment drives which mirrored that of the Indian National Congress, the AICIC was essentially a Protestant association. It was also purely Indian in membership, unlike all other bodies of similar territorial reach, such as the National Missionary Council, later National Christian Council. Although not a political party, it tried to present itself to the government as the mouthpiece of Indian Christians, and was accepted to be at least one of the most important ones. One issue that constantly divided the members of this organization is whether political representation of Indian Christians would be best secured by a general electorate or through the implementation of community-specific electorates, that is, separate electorates, whereby only Christians could elect Christian leaders to reserved parliamentary seats. Between 1914 and 47, this matter was constantly debated within the AICIC, with the non-sectarian view gaining only a precarious dominance in the 1920s, and even then it was challenged very seriously in the 1930s once again. And this dominance came about mainly under the leadership of a man called Kanakarayan Thiruselvam Paul, or K.T. Paul, a Tamil Protestant layman from Salem, who in his career and ideas brought together all those features of Indian Christianity that we have discussed so far, resentment of foreign missionary control, a rejection of racial and cultural inferiority, a service orientation, and a non-confrontational approach to other religions. K.T. Paul's entry into public life began with his co-option by the YMCA in 1905, and in 1916 he became the first Indian National General Secretary of the YMCA of India, Ceylon and Burma, actually. Paul was also a founder member of the AICIC in 1914 and its president in 1923. He represented the Indian Christians in the first roundtable conference in London on Indian constitutional reforms in 1930. When Paul died, tributes from leading Indian politicians, including Gandhi, applauded his ability to prevent his faith from diluting his nationalism. Let us tarry a while and trace the outlines of K.T. Paul's career and ideas. Speaking to the Calcutta Missionary Conference in 1912, that is the fourth decennial gathering of most Protestant mission societies in India, Paul pilloried foreign missionaries for behaving like hyper-organized dominators rather than true gurus. He deplored the separation of mission and church, that topic again, the automatic exclusion of Indians from missions, and the expectation that the Indian church would, in quotes, receive and shepherd proselytes secured by the mission and conduct a little fancy home mission in its neighborhood. In an indirect reference to Dalit Christians, Paul acknowledged that the Indian church was drawn from such social strata as lacked leadership qualities. And yet, he pointed out, the Madras University had produced 1,200 to 1,300 Indian Christian graduates, no doubt much more equipped to be leaders. But in Sadhu Sundar Singh, he said, Indian Christians in the South and North had a leader par excellence. The urgent problem really was, according to him, that of race. As for Paul's religious views, he was also founder member and director of the National Missionary Society, an indigenous missionary society formed in 1906 with YMCA support, through which Paul no doubt sought to fulfill his ambition of the Indian church leading missions rather than the other way around. However, by 1916, Paul privately confessed his doctrinal perplexity in a letter to a friend. After the World War, he said, I feel that though my conviction is strong enough to determine my own conduct, I cannot propagate.